and I'm so strung out. I'm high as a kite, I just might stop to check you out. Let me go on, like I glister in the sun. Let me go on.
Hello.
Happy Cinco de Mayo.
Cinco de Mayo. And the 4th of July was yesterday.
The 4th of May.
Oh, what the fuck am I talking about? The 4th of... I got it all messed up.
May the 4th
be with you.
And free comic book day.
Yeah. I don't know what month I'm in.
Yeah.
They just kind of all mesh into one.
Just like... your podcast episode numbers.
Yeah. Dyslexia setting in.
Yeah.
That last one, I on DC Noise, I just inverted the numbers.
Yeah.
The 2 and the 1.
Yeah. Hey, as long as everybody knows it's a new episode, that's the important thing.
What happens.
Yeah.
So what have you been up to?
Not too much. Cutting the grass. Starting to be that time of year.
Oh, yeah. We got snow on Sunday, yeah. Or no, it was Friday.
Uh-huh.
It was pretty good snow, too.
Wow, that's crazy. Yeah, it's starting to be spring, beginning of summer kind of here. You know, like 60s and 70s and stuff. It's been pretty nice.
Well, I went walking Harley, and I saw like a bunch of... sprinklers that people turned on and they were all frozen and busted, you know, the sprinkler heads.
Dang. So was it an unseasonal snow? Was it unexpected? Is it weird?
Nah, we get some snow through, I think, mid-May or potential.
Mm-hmm.
But it is unusual to, like, freeze like that, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny... you know, living near Buffalo seemed to have a reputation for having tons of snow, but there are places that get more snow. And, I mean, technically Syracuse, just 3 hours east of here, has more snow than we do most winters.
Yeah.
But because of, you know, the blizzard in the 70s and other different things, you know, we have the reputation. So did you, I think I saw on Facebook that you sort of set Free Comic Book Day out.
Yeah, I did. Did you?
I did too, actually. Yeah, pretty much. I mean, well, I say pretty much, but yeah, I did. I mean, I put my t-shirt on, my Free Comic Book Day t-shirt, and I did my part because I was out at, I ran out to Best Buy, and, I was wearing my shirt, and one of the guys working there asked me about Free Comic Book Day.
Ah, she spread the word.
Yeah, I spread the word. He said, Free Comic Book Day, when's that? I said, it's today. And he said, where do I go to get free comics? And I said, any comic book shop. And he said, oh, like that. And, you know, it happened that we were...
You should have said the word any participating.
Yeah.
Because... there are comic shops here in the Colorado Springs that just don't participate because they lose money. In other words, like I guess that owner thought, well, I'm spending all this because they're spending money on free comics. They have to spend on shipping and then a certain a small portion on the comic itself.
Yeah.
But if they don't make money that day, I guess it's not profitable for certain people if there's just a bunch of people going in for free comics. So.
Yeah, I don't know if all... we have an unusual number of shops here for the size of the community and everything.
Yeah.
It's a smaller city, but the big ones, the major ones do. There was actually a little write-up in the business section of Buffalo News yesterday that had...
locations to go to, or...?
Yeah, it talked about Free Comic Book Day and what it is. They interviewed the owner of one of the shops here, Don's Atomic Comics, and had a picture of him, and he talked about how, you know, for him it's profitable. He gets a whole bunch of the free comic books, and he usually does like 3 or 4 times what he would normally do in a day on that day. And probably the oldest shop in the area. It's been around for decades now, Queen City Comics. I was looking on Facebook. They posted pictures of their event, and looks like they had a lot of people. And it's a small shop, but they had like stuff set out on the sidewalk and stuff.
Yeah. Well, some shops, it's really a big deal. Like, they get artists to do sketches, and they have people, creators show up, and it's kind of a big deal.
Yeah, I don't think any of them, besides doing some sales and stuff, have really even the space. Most of the shops around here are like in little plazas or something like that, and just are kind of small.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you know, it seems like it's a good event.
I still got my 5 free comics from DCBS that are going to ship to me next week. So
yeah,
I don't even remember what I got, but I remembered I got the DC one. I always get those because maybe there's a surprise, like last year's had the Trinity in it or something, you know, Pandora. And
right.
I don't want to miss out. The other ones I don't really care about, except I wanted to try that Aphrodite, but I didn't order it. I didn't realize it was a number one. Like they're going to solicit number two. And I didn't realize this was the number one, but I did find it on Comixology because Comixology has some of the free comics. They at least had 14 of them.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember. I think I got The Walking Dead.
Yeah, I heard that had some exclusive content in it too.
Yeah. Yeah, usually, I mean, you can't always tell, but I usually try to at least pick out ones that aren't don't have like repeat information, or I mean reprints.
Yeah.
And I usually just kind of do like indie or interesting stuff, but yeah, I don't know if that kid ended up going, but I directed him to the nearest comic shop.
That's cool that somebody asked. I did see a little kid dressed up as a Jedi Knight at the grocery store. I wonder if he went.
Nice. They had some kind of
the
4th, because they had some kind of
May the 4th be with you. That's probably why he was dressed like that. I didn't even think about it. Yeah, I was like, why is this kid in a Jedi robe? I don't get it. And I even said that I even asked him, are you a Jedi? And he was busy just making noises and going I think he thought he was Yoda or something.
I know the Toys R Us nearby had some kind of an event that tied into May the 4th.
Oh, like some Star Wars toys specials and stuff? Or
something like that. But I think there was actually something going on there. It was from 12 to 2, and it said something about Yoda Chronicles or something like that. I don't really know what it was, but they had it on their website.
Yeah.
But
if I went, I would have gone just to be more curious to see who's buying what. That always fascinates me when you bring people in. What are they buying, or if they're buying anything at all?
Right. Yeah, I guess at least for the show or the shop that they interviewed in the news, it's profitable. So.
Yeah, my particular shop makes a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a really good, like triple a good Friday for him, like, or a good Wednesday, sorry, because Wednesdays are his busiest days. So.
Yeah, I think you know, there's some people out there that are cheap, but I think most people realize that the whole point is to get people into the shop and to, you know, when they have an event like that, that it's not required, but it's sort of, you know, it's sort of a dick move to not buy anything.
A lot of people don't even know what's free. A lot of people just start, there's a lot of good free for all. And then they go to the cash register with like 15 books and they're all the current books, you know? Sorry, these aren't the free ones.
Oh, so I found what the Toys R Us event was. Looks like it was pretty much across the board. They had a in-store event, I guess, because there's a new cartoon coming up called The Yoda Chronicles.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's aimed at little kids, and it was for children ages 5 and up. They could build a mini version of Jack 13 Stealth Starfighter out of Legos.
Oh, that's cool.
So, yeah, so.
I like Legos. I would have liked to do that, but I'm not in that age group.
Well, it just says children age 5 and up. I don't know where the cutoff is. There's no cutoff, so. So, like, I still think of my interests are the same as when I was a kid. Does that count?
Does that count? I'm the only old dude there.
Yeah.
Probably get arrested.
I could use some tips from that guy, that documentary you guys covered on DC Noise that impersonated children.
Oh, yeah, that was a weird dude.
Yeah. That you're just trying to get free Legos instead of infiltrate someone's family.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, other than that, not too much going on. Just starting to get in the spring mood. It's nice to have the windows open and doing some outside yard work and things like that.
Yeah. I get a lot of podcasts listened to when I'm working in the yard.
Yeah.
During the regular week, I don't, so.
Right, yeah, you don't have as many chances.
Yeah.
Are you able to listen to anything when you cut the grass?
When it's the grass, when I cut the grass, it's so damn loud.
Yeah.
That I usually listen to music because I could hear all the music.
Yeah.
The podcast, I don't always hear.
Yeah, I've tried it before to try to make use of that time, but it's just...
If it's anything else other than the grass, yeah, I can hear it good. I can listen to podcasts. It's just that my mower is it's a loud mower.
Yeah. Yeah, same here. Music, you don't really have to hear every detail, but when it's people talking, it's hard to follow the conversation and stuff, but... But I'll do that sometimes when I'm cleaning, you know, around the house or something.
Mm-hmm.
Just to make time go by.
Cool deal. Well, this time we're breaking away from the mold. We don't have any Jack Kirby today.
No.
I mean, no Jack Kirby omnibus.
All right. Taking a little break.
You do have the next volume, though, right?
Yep. Yeah, I have 3 and 4.
Oh, cool. Did you get a... Do you have OMAC, by the way, or no?
Yep.
Cool deal.
Yeah, I don't have all the ones that they've released. I would like to...
Do you have the OMAC hardcover or the trade paperback?
OMAC, I have hardcover.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the only ones I was looking into trying to get the hardcovers for the Fourth World, and I could get some of them, but I wasn't sure if I would be able to get all of them, and I wanted to have them all in the same format if I could, so
yeah.
I just decided to go with the paperbacks, but everything else I've been able to get of their Kirby I've been able to get in hardcover.
Yeah, I just got the latest one with Superpowers.
It
is like super thick. It's like the thickest one yet. I haven't opened it yet, but man, it looks like a lot of material.
Yeah, I'd like to grab that. It's just with the sometimes you don't know how long they're going to keep these things in print when it comes to the hardcovers, both with DC and Marvel.
Yeah,
you know, you might end up with a trade, or you know, if you wait too long, it might go out of print for a while. So
yeah, the one that I regret not buying that I wanted is the New Teen Titans Omnibus, the all New Teen Titans Omnibus, the one with George Perez and Marv Wolfman.
Yeah.
It's already out of print, the first one.
I know. I know, because that's how I funded buying an actual copy of Issues 1, 2, and DC Comics Presents 26 by selling mine, because I bought mine like 50% off, you know, originally. And I don't find them that comfortable to read once they get to a certain size, and that was just kind of on the borderline.
Yeah.
That unless I sat with it in my, like, sat cross-legged with it in my lap, I found it a little uncomfortable to read, and I had everything else in it besides those issues I just mentioned in actual print copies, so
mm-hmm.
I found out it was out of print, and I got curious and looked on eBay, and I ended up selling it for, like, more than cover price, so I made like over 50%
over 50%. That's a good deal.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was like 80 or 90 bucks I sold it for, so.
Well, they're going for like 130 now.
Nice. It might have been, I'd have to check, but I know I made enough money to buy the original issues and have some left over, I think, so.
Mm-hmm. Which I'd rather have anyway, the original. The only convenience to the one on the bookshelf is it's easier to get to and read than to find something in a long box or something.
Yeah, honestly, it was just, the appeal of completing the run up to, wherever it is that mine ends. And, the issues, if I continue the run, they're all cheaper issues, so it's, those will be easy to come by. But, so I think it was a good move.
Mm-hmm.
Nice to have that completed.
So we went into the Flash Chronicles, Volume 1, Barry Allen. Did you read the first three?
Yep.
All right. Yeah. So we covered Showcase number 4, which is supposed to be the new Silver Age, like the first book to spawn off the Silver Age. And number 8 and number 13. It's kind of odd the way they did it. I think Showcase was just launch it, and I guess Flash must have had a lot of letters or something, or a lot of sales, so they launched it 4 issues later.
Yeah, again. I guess. And it was, and I don't think it was monthly, because 4 came out in October of 1956, and then 8 came out in June of 57.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think the feedback process was slower, for the issues to get out. Everything, you're working with mail, so, by the time they find out that people really like the issue, like the character, and get the ball rolling on doing some new stories or whatnot, some time had passed. It's not like, they have people reacting on Twitter as soon as the issue comes out,
Right.
I think so. The pencils on all the issues were Carmine Infantino.
Yep, and that's who we're kind of doing this for, because he just recently passed away.
Yeah, it's kind of the motivator there. Each issue has 2 stories. One of them written by Robert Kaniger, and the other written by John Broom. And the inker varies. Showcase number 4, it's Joe Kubert. And in number 8, it's Frank Giacoa. And then in 13, the first story is by Joe Giella, and the second is Frank Giacoa. So, Showcase number 4. I mean, it's pretty probably one of the most iconic issues up there. One of the most famous issues in DC Comics history and comics history in general. I mean, like you said, it pretty much is considered to have kicked off the Silver Age.
And this one's humorous. I've read this, but man, I read it. I don't remember any of it when I did read it, because I had a hardcover. It's probably out of print, but. Called The Greatest Flash Stories Ever Told, and I think this one was in it.
Oh, yeah.
And
most likely.
This one is interesting because Barry's sitting there during an electrical storm with his carton of milk.
Yeah.
Reading Flash comics with Jay Garrick.
Yeah.
Before he gets electrocuted. And
it's lunch break or something.
Yeah. And just like Spider-Man, as soon as he gets a taxi and he's running to catch the cab, he realizes, what the hell? I got super speed. And then he goes to a diner and somebody drops all kinds of stuff and he's able to catch it. Mm-hmm. And he's just noticing a whole bunch of stuff. There's a bullet going towards somebody. Or it's Iris, actually.
Yeah.
And he actually saves her from getting shot by a stray bullet. that was fired at the Turtle Man.
The slowest man alive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Obviously, a lot of things about this are pretty well known. You know, the fact that really, in some ways, you know, it's the first appearance, I guess, of Earth One, because the fact that they, at the time, I think it was just, you know, they were making an effort to revitalize their superhero properties, and they decided to make a new version of the Flash instead of Jay Garrick. So they had Barry Allen reading about Jay Garrick, so it became that, you know, the Golden Age superheroes and whatnot in the DC universe, you know, the Justice Society never existed on Earth One, and you know, you got the whole concept beginning here. I mean, retroactively, they would decide that these are different Earths, and that's why there's two Flashes.
You could think of it as like the New 52 back then.
Yeah.
This is the first book.
Yeah.
And then there's some fans saying, you know, what the hell? This ain't Jay Garrick. This is not my Flash.
Yeah. Pretty much. And I guess they just took a different approach to it. They were even more radical because they didn't have, you know, it's probably as established a fandom. I mean, they just, not only is it not their Jay Garrick, it's not, you know, even the same person, you know. It's not just like a younger version of Jay Garrick or something.
Right.
It's a totally different being, or a different person.
But he becomes the Flash because of reading Jay Garrick comics. He's like, I could use this, and he immediately makes this awesome ring that, you know, pops out his costume, and he can get dressed in no time. And they make it a point in every issue to show that ring.
They do, yeah. You know, he's definitely, there's definitely a strong connection in terms of the fact that he's inspired by Jay Garrick. And I'll point out one panel that you, you know, the different events that happen as he's discovering that he now has powers. I really like, it's page 10 in the trade paperback where he's seeing the food,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it, when you're trying to depict the fact that time has stopped in a comic book, which is a static image, it's probably, I would think it would be kind of easy to go wrong there and mess that up. And I think Infantino does a really good job of making it seem, you know, making it clear that time has stopped.
Because he's just staring at the hot dogs.
Yeah, with fries. All the hot dogs and the pie and the fries and the peas and the coffee, everything just kind of levitating there.
Even the liquid, it's not dripping. It's upside down, but it's not dripping. Yeah, that's so, a panel.
That's pretty neat. But yeah, he, you know, one thing throughout these issues I think is emphasized a lot is his science. You know, science comes up a lot. It's some of the villains are science powered, and a lot of like scientific facts are mentioned and discussed. And I like kind of how that connects into him being a police scientist. It sort of gives the book a unique flavor in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and connects to his secret identity. You know, the Turtle Man himself is a little goofy.
Yeah, he's just wearing a sweater.
Yeah,
he's and some wearing, green pants.
Yeah. you know, but his whole thing, I mean, obviously, I thought, okay, we're going to have the fastest man alive. What's the opposite of that? The slowest man alive, you know? Turtles are slow.
Yeah. He tried to outthink him, and it didn't work.
Yeah. You know, he does a bunch of funny kind of booby traps. You know, it's like he's kind of like his methods of slowing down the Flash are all kind of not really like superpower based. It's just he'll, you know, sabotage a
speedboat
and different things that he does to technically slow him down. But they're all kind of, like I said, technicalities.
Yeah,
but you have to appreciate the fact that it doesn't waste time getting them set up. I mean, within like a few pages, he's got his powers. He's processed the fact that he now has powers. He's decided on his secret identity and taken on a new costume. And, you know, things get moving really quickly like they did back in the day.
Yeah. And Turtle Man is defeated in no time.
Yeah, he's...
in a matter of three pages, he's defeated.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about this is they're doing the dual stories, and you're either getting 12 to 13 pages, and then you get another story.
Yep.
But in the first issue, you get Turtle Man. In the second, this is still the same issue, you get... what's that guy's name? Mazan, or... I can't remember.
Yeah, it's... Mazdan.
Mazdan. It's the first appearance of him. I don't remember this guy ever appearing, but he's a villain from the future, just like Abracadabra, if you will, the magician from the future. And he's got like all kinds of electrical gadgets going haywire.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting to see that the whole concept of time travel and the Flash using his powers. His speed powers to travel in time and break through the time barrier. Mm. And that whole concept occurs so early, you know, in just the second story, something that'll be a part of, you know, the Flash's universe, as it were, is established already. He even mentions as he hits the time barrier that it feels like he's running on a treadmill, foreshadowing
his time traveling
thing. So, I was surprised to see. Basically, this is the guy, right? That was a criminal who he was a criminal in the future, and they basically wanted to. Punish him by sending him even farther into the future to the 50th century, which they're basically using as a prison because at that point the planet is desolated. And instead, there's an accident and he gets sent back to the 20th century. So, you know, Flash's task here basically, and the reason that he ends up traveling through time with Mazdan is to take him back to his time of origin and get him. Give them a second chance to send them where they're meant to.
Yeah. He's a villain that could really be a hardcore villain for the Flash, and I wonder why he didn't take off. But
yeah, he's not.
He got arrested really quick too. Like he was robbing a bank and Flash came to stop him, and he stopped him like the first try, got him into jail, but this guy has this chemically treated lens, and he breaks out of jail in no time.
Yeah,
and then
I like
he
that,
finds him in his rocket, and then he agrees to send him back to the future.
Yeah, it's funny to me that no matter what their actual motivation for doing so, most villains rob a bank. They may want to do something different with the money, but they pretty much that's their main. Modus operandi is getting into banks, and it's interesting how that's kind of a progression in some ways. You know, you had in the Golden Age, especially when the Golden Age was kicking off, you know, you had Batman and Superman fighting a lot of just, you know, gangsters and uncostumed criminals. You know, even though we got costumed criminals and more scientific villains here, you know, they're still kind of focused on robbing banks.
But he already cracks the time barrier. That just shows there's no mention of the Speed Force, but he's already cracking the time barrier and takes him back just by running around a track.
Yeah, and I would say that that's one of the things that I took away from this issue was just being impressed with the fact that that concept was introduced so early.
And he almost doesn't have to learn this stuff. Like, he's not gradually learning stuff. He's just, I could do this, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think some of that's a symptom of the style of writing of the time, you know.
It's reverse decompressed storytelling.
Yeah, it's very compressed.
And if this was a Bendis book, it would have lasted at least 12 issues.
Oh yeah, definitely the first story probably. But, you know,
Turtle Man would have been 12 issues, and then he would have been another 12 issues.
The epic story of Turtle Man. But yeah, I mean, there's positives and negatives of both approaches. Obviously, when you're reading Silver Age comics, you're not going to get a lot of subtlety and
characterization. You really
characterization.
Yeah, you don't really know Barry. I mean, you know he's always late. You scratch your head why Iris just doesn't dump him, because he just can't make a date no matter what.
Yeah. Yeah, just like you know, Green Lantern's difficulty with the color yellow. They kind of, even in reading these three issues, they pretty much, there's some themes that they hammer on, you know, and the joke of the fastest man alive being late crops up pretty much in every single story. Mm-hmm. And yeah, Iris at times pretty hardcore. Barry can't catch a break, and she's not too kind to him about it. But what can you do?
Yeah. It's interesting reading this and then reading the new Flash. Mm-hmm. To see the parallels a little bit. In the new Flash, he's with that other scientist girl, but he seems like Iris is using him for stories and stuff and to help her brother.
Mm-hmm.
And this one, she's a reporter as well, but she's not using him. She just, every time they make a date, either an event happens and she wants to report on it, but he's just never makes it or has a headache. Yeah. I have a headache.
Yeah, I would say the Barry and Iris relationship in these early issues definitely has a nature that seems pulled right kind of from 50s sitcoms and stuff of what, mm-hmm, I've seen of them. You know, it's very kind of hits the same note over and over again. They don't really, like you said, they persist in the relationship even though they sort of hit the same problem over and over again that's, you know, pulled for as much mileage as they can get out of the humor of Barry being late and, you know, the sort of befuddled male and the slightly you know, tight ass female.
Mm-hmm.
And their interactions, but showcase number 8, you know, we get story.
Did you notice the cover of that, like at the top it says in this issue a list of DC contest winners? I wonder what that was about.
Yeah, I did see that. It made me wish that I had, you know, that they reprinted more, like, more than just the, you know, the issue pages. They you know, would reprint the extra stuff. I like looking at that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's another reason why I was, you know, I like having the individual issues as Teen Titans.
Yeah.
Because I like looking at the letters column and, you know, see what people, fans that were reading at the time, how they were reacting to stuff, you know, without the benefit of, you know, what would it be like 30, 40 years of hindsight, you know,
mm-hmm,
just right at that time, how they thought of things. So it's kind of neat to see, but yeah, that's kind of funny.
And that in this style of storytelling, they do a good job of like putting Flash in a predicament or showing you a one page predicament and then showing you how he got there and then finishing the story.
Yeah.
That seemed to be the style of storytelling in the time. DC did a lot of that. I read a lot of Superman, and that's like they stick you in the middle of the story in the first opening scene.
Mm-hmm.
And then they tell you how he got there and then finish the story.
Yeah, I think that really that style persists even to the end of the Bronze Age. I mean, I know like issues of like DC Comics Presents and stuff like that from the early 80s did the exact same thing, you know?
I guess they felt that they used that first page as, like, the cover as well, like, to draw you into the story. Like,
right.
Why is Flash falling off this tightrope?
Right, exactly. Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
I found this one to be interesting from a criminal perspective. I kind of liked it because they're in Central City and this box just appears. And it's got everybody just like, what the hell is this box doing here? How do we get into this box? So it's got the whole city captivated while these triplicates, I don't even think they name the triplicates, but there's like three thieves go about robbing places.
Right.
While people are paying attention to this huge box, thinking it's from space or does it have explosives in it or what's going on?
Yeah. Yeah, they finally get the first box open just as Flash is apprehending the first of the criminals, and they all wear like a suit and top hat, or a tux and top hat with a golden half mask on, like Phantom of the Opera style. And Flash locks up the first of the triplets, and he just cracks up, and he's like, why the hell is this guy laughing at me? So they get the box open, meanwhile, and there's another box inside. So they start working on that box, try to get that open. All of a sudden, you know, another one of the triplets robs another bank, and Flash locks him up, and then they're both laughing. Sure enough, they get the second box open, and there's a third box inside. I mean, it's like a clever little idea. It almost reminds me of the style of like a Twilight Zone episode or something like that.
Where yeah.
It's like kind of clever.
Looks like that new movie that's coming out with Morgan Freeman and those magic guys, where they're it's like they're using the magic show as the box, and they have some alternative motives to like rob banks and give to the poor or something. I don't understand it, but it's a similar premise.
Gotcha.
This is and then he's late and he forgot Iris's coffee and sandwich, but she still walks out with him.
Yeah. He's like, well, you didn't give me dinner, so how about you buy me dinner? I mean, you didn't give me lunch, so how about you buy me dinner?
Mm-hmm.
But I like that, and it's an example of, you know, little, you know, not anything major, but little science tidbits. The last of the triplets. He has an electrified tux, and you know Flash is trying to apprehend him in the bank, so he picks up since he doesn't have a non-conductor like paper, he does the opposite and he picks up a big fistfuls of silver. And throws it at the guy's suit and keeps throwing silver at him until it discharges all of the electricity. And he grabs him at that point. So just little things like that. Like if you were a kid in the 50s, you'd be like, oh, that's interesting. And
yeah, a little retain science
that,
fact.
You know, and then, you know. But so I like how that connects throughout these issues. I like
yeah, they'll have that. Little editor's notes explaining things.
Yeah. And I mean, I think they did that. Sometimes just regardless of the fact, because they were thinking about, okay, we're writing these for kids. Let's try to teach them something. But in this case, I like the fact that it reflects the profession of the hero's alter ego, you know.
And then we get to the second story within number 8, which introduces my favorite rogue villain and probably... I would have to say, I don't know if there's another one, but the most popular one, I mean, at least well-known Flash villain is Captain Cold. He even had an appearance on the TV show, the short-lived Flash TV show.
Yeah, the live-action one.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I would say. I mean, he's usually depicted as the leader of the rogues.
Yeah, and he's got the sister, the Golden Glider. And Jeff Johns has really describe this character really well. Like, I think he's made him more of a person than any of the other prior people that have handled him.
Yeah, he did that with a lot of the rogues.
Yeah.
Really fleshed them out and gave them deep backgrounds and personalities and stuff. But I will give a lot of credit, you know, just like Flash's costume, to Carmen Infantino with his early designs for the rogues. I mean, it's hard to design costumes that last, just as we've seen with the New 52 and some of their attempts to fix what didn't need to be fixed when it comes to some of these costumes.
This costume is just awesome. It's one of my favorite ones.
It's awesome, and it pretty much, I mean, here in the 50s, yeah, it's pretty much what it is today with, like, minor modifications. I mean, Infantino was pretty good at designing character costumes, I have to say. And I think the fact that they last is the main, you know, testament to how good something is, you know.
Mm-hmm. And Flash, who has probably the second most popular rogues villains next to Batman, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Some would argue Spider-Man, but I'm a DC guy.
Yeah, well, it can, yeah, at least in the DC universe.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, at its core, the concept, you know, probably comes from the fact that Flash is all about running, and it's pretty hard to run on slippery ice, you know. So at a base level, it's a pretty simple idea, but like you said, I mean, the costume and you know, even though, like you said, years and years later Geoff Johns would flesh it out even more, we do get some background you know, about Captain Cold as Len Snart, you know. Just like the Flash, I mean, one of the reasons the Flash, and in my case, it's the Wally West Flash, but, you know, I have an affection for the whole Flash family, because they kind of, the other Flashes sort of fit this, role as well. Sort of true to the Midwest location of, like, Keystone, Central City, they kind of have this, there's this, sort of working class, aspect to the Flash universe, how even the Flash rogues are kind of, you know, they're not crooks on some sort of cosmic Superman sort of level, you know. Even though Flash has superpowers and he's not like Batman, you know, just a human, his rogues sort of fit the fact that the Flash is Jay, Barry, and Wally together all sort of have this kind of, like, everyman, blue-collar sort of ethic about them as people. So I feel like we get a little bit of a taste of that with the background that we get on Captain Cold, Len Snart, here. He's, yeah, kind of like a crook trying to get a break, you know?
He's a crook looking for some way to fight the Flash because he knows he can't do it just going out and doing it.
Yeah.
Just so he finds the cyclotron, and we get an editor's note in here. It says a cyclotron is a device for imparting very high speeds to electrified particles by successive electric impulses at high frequency. So he's going to steal the cyclotron, and he actually runs across a gun, and it actually gets hit with the cyclotron and makes the gun his cold device. It's like, mm-hmm, an accident that happens.
Yeah. And I like that when he's coming up with his identity, they have other possibilities that he thought of. Mr. Arctic, the Cold Wave, Sub-Zero, and best of all, Human Icicle.
Yeah.
And Sub-Zero.
Maybe a tribute to the icicle from the Golden Age.
Yeah. Sub-Zero made me smirk because growing up playing the Mortal Kombat games. Yeah, like, well, somebody ended up using that one. The other ones, I can see why people have passed on.
And his gun can make like polar bears.
Yeah. So it's
got like hallucinogenic effects. Like it could make a polar bear, but then it just fades away. They're like temporary constructs, which I've never seen him do in the modern age.
No, I think I'm kind of not surprised they dropped that. I mean, I guess the concept behind it is that the temperature at which his gun is shooting out is so low, it's absolute zero, that it causes hallucinations. Mm-hmm. Very specific hallucinations, you know, and it's a little bit, despite the fact that they are putting in scientific fact and stuff like that, I don't know how scientifically accurate that particular concept is. So I can see how they sort of drop that, but that's what he uses on the Flash here. Flash sees a bunch of like staircases coming at him. And then he thinks that he's stuck in the middle of a merry-go-round of weird creatures and stuff.
Yeah, like horses with chicken feet and chicken heads and all kinds of weird creatures.
Yeah. So, like, so he's spinning around and Captain Cold's laughing at him for thinking that he's believing in the hallucinations and stuff, but once he breaks out, he doesn't have much trouble taking him down. But I like that Barry gets back to work, and the last panel, he's got his hands over the Bunsen burner because his hands are cold from fighting.
It seems like all he would have to do is rub them together at high speed.
Yeah,
because he does use that against Mr. Element in a future issue.
Oh, true. Yeah. Speaking of Showcase. What's this, number 10 now?
13.
This actually, this cover made me laugh out loud. He's, the Flash is running, and and he's thinking, no matter how fast I go, this pirate torpedo keeps following me. The concept of a pirate torpedo made me chuckle, but it's basically like a huge torpedo with a pirate flag stuck on the front of it.
Yeah.
It's kind of goofy, but the whole concept of this issue is based around the World in 80 Days story, which Barry and Iris have just seen at the movie theater as the issue begins. They're discussing the whole concept of, Iris doesn't know that Barry is the Flash, so. But the Flash is pretty well known around town at this point, and they're talking about whether the Flash, how fast the Flash could get around the world.
He develops this cool watch that can get in police waves or police reports from all over the world, mm-hmm. And that's how this story opens up. Is he's got this watch? He hears something going on in France, near the Eiffel Tower. And he rushes over there, and you learn he can run on water here.
Mm-hmm.
He's just running on water. He can run upside of buildings. He can run up on a string, like when the triplets cut the wire and the high wire. He basically ran up the string, even if it was just hanging vertically.
Yeah.
So he's pretty damn powerful. I've seen him leap across buildings in here, like mm-hmm. Superman. At high speed, but he seems really, really freaking powerful. I guess when I came in here, I didn't realize how powerful. Like how could any of these rogues stand a chance?
Yeah,
with somebody running at light speed,
right?
It time travel. Funny. You know what I mean? If he fails, well, he could just go back in time and stop you later.
Right. Yeah, I think that's been a challenge throughout the years for the various writers of Flash comics to try to maintain that balance, you know, be true to the history with the various rogues and stuff, but also make it seem like, you know, that they're a valid threat. And I think that's why eventually you see them teaming up, you know, because you need six or seven of them together to, you know, as a group to actually seem like a real threat to them.
Of all the villains, the guy from the future had potential, and then Mr. Element, except he just got arrogant.
Yeah. Yeah, when he gets to Paris, it's basically this dude, the Black Cat, or Le Chat Noir. And he's not too much trouble. One thing that did interest me, though, is that as far as the way he looks, he kind of reminds me of the way that the wizard... the weather wizard will look later on.
I thought he looked more like Abracadabra in black.
Yeah, not so much like the costume, just like just his head.
Oh, yeah. Really? His hair.
His hair, yeah. And the fact that he's... It's the Flash making the whirlwind, but I guess like on page 60, it's a cool panel where the Black Cat's in the foreground in the whirlwind above Flash. Because basically what he does is the Black Cat has a bomb. So in order to like save the girl that's there, with one hand he's creating a whirlwind to you know, an updraft so that to slow their descent to the ground. And then with his other hand he's creating a downdraft to keep the Black Cat stuck holding the bomb so that he doesn't drop it. And, you know, so basically the theme of this story is the Flash keeps attempting to go back home, keeps getting different, you know, police wave reports from different places around the world. And I liked it, like, every single time it cracked me up that there would be some attractive young lady involved.
That made me laugh too.
He got
at least three kisses in this issue before he got to Iris, and he didn't get a kiss from Iris.
Yeah. There's the cute French girl, and then when he gets to Egypt, there's a woman there who is a princess, I think.
Mm-hmm. She's kidnapped.
Yeah, kidnapped princess. He saves her, and I mean, she.
He took down a whole pyramid.
Yeah. And he rebuilds the pyramid in a few seconds.
Mm-hmm. And then in Tibet is the third one.
Yeah. There's a young lady in a parka.
It says, "My life is in your hands, Scarlet Whirlwind."
Yeah. I thought it did make me smile because it's kind of amusing that you know, we're only three issues in and pretty much everybody in the entire world knows who the Flash is and recognizes him. But actually, I mean, there's a final one, the aforementioned pirate torpedo. The Flash manages to redirect it so it smashes into its own submarine.
Oh yeah, and there's another girl there.
Fourth one.
It's the captain of the ship.
The captain of the ship turns out to be a blonde woman, and she gives him a big kiss and wants him to come aboard. But he freaks out because she says it's Tuesday, and last he knew it was Monday, so he thinks he's a whole day late for his date with Iris. But
it's like, I messed this up again.
Yeah. thankfully, he realizes when he gets back that he crossed the international date line when he was running around and got back in time for once. But he doesn't get a kiss from Iris. He's kissed out.
I just love the girl in Egypt, the one that says, "You are swifter than the desert hawk, El Flash."
Yeah.
"Not only have you swept the bandits off their feet, handsome one, but me too. Must you depart so soon, Flash of my heart?" Oh god, this is good.
He's setting up like a the worldwide harem here.
I don't need Iris. I got women all across the world.
All over the world.
If I'm late for my date, I can just go to France.
Yeah. He's always on time for a date somewhere. But he's a man of principles.
Yeah.
So.
And then I think this guy, Mr. Element, he had the biggest potential to taking out the Flash. But he just got arrogant. He'd like beat him. Mm-hmm. And then get away, and then he got that like Batman villain thing where he's like obsessed more with the Flash than he is with stealing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. But yeah, this was interesting because it's very, in this regard, in this aspect, very science based.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
he's got villains like henchmen like Argon and Radon and. All kinds of elements.
And Krypton.
And I think it's funny though how he's got his henchmen and his henchmen. What do you mean we're not dividing up the money? Oh, I get half and you guys could divide up the other half.
Yeah. I thought we were splitting it. Yeah, we are. Half to me and half to all of you.
And the thing that really freaked me out though, like if he wasn't running it at top speed, he had made this like gold wire, like you couldn't even see it, so thin it's like wire. It seemed like it would have just like sliced him up into pieces as he ran into it.
Yeah,
like his head would have been gone and everything else, but it was more like a wall. He hit it and came to a complete stop and they escape.
Yeah,
after stealing stuff.
Yeah, I guess that would have been a little gory for the 50s.
Well, I'm sure they had more gory stuff and Tales from the Crypt.
Yeah. But, yeah, you're right. He does seem like a pretty valid. And I like that he gets sent out into space and, you know, ends up, instead of rocketing forever and ever, he gets himself into the orbit of the moon, sends himself back in, but doesn't have to really worry about re-entering the Earth's atmosphere at all.
Yeah,
and burning up. But it does address the fact that he does mention that he held his breath the brief moment that he was actually out in space. So they considered that aspect of it at least.
And they give Mr. Element's origin, and he starts off as a kid as evil. Like, he's evil from the very beginning.
Yeah, pretty much. He said he was, well, at least he was, as a kid, really fascinated, by science and by in particular by chemistry and the different elements and stuff. And when he got older and... had ambitions toward evil. He remembered all that reading that he had did as a kid and that fascination that he had.
Now he can take off the Flash or take him out.
Yeah.
Yeah, that rocketing him to space was kind of ridiculous. But
yeah.
It's good about that they try to explain everything.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he just used the moon, a gravitational field, and propelled himself back. They were already having a party down on Earth, like, hey, we launched him into space, he's gonna go on forever, how's he gonna get out of that?
Right.
But it was enjoyable. I enjoyed it, not as much as the Kirby stuff, but I did enjoy it.
Yeah, I like seeing the origin of different ideas, and I was pretty impressed with Infantino's pencils, very, very clean, very, very good storytelling aspect to him, I would say. I didn't really ever feel confused about what was going on,
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy to read and just look. It's one of those things that if it's working well, if they're doing their job, you shouldn't really notice it.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually when penciler doesn't do a very good job, and you start to get confused as to what's going on, that you start to notice the storytelling, you know?
Yeah. He draws a pretty iris.
Yeah. Yeah, he does. Yeah, I think even throughout the three issues, I feel like you get, you know, Barry and Iris, their faces become more and more defined and sort of unique to them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
By Showcase 13, you know, Barry and Iris look like really, like, individually recognizable people, you know? Not just like a generic blonde guy, and not that they were as far, like, as bad as generic in the beginning, but I feel like they come more refined as you get through the issues.
Cool deal. All right, we have a few questions from William Purcell this morning. Are there any retro style trades you'd recommend?
You know, not just because we just talked about one, but I do think that the, I really do enjoy the fact that the DC are doing these Chronicles series. I wish they'd come out sooner, but, I'm sure, you know, they take a little time to do, but because they're making them affordable, you know?
Yeah. You'd never be able to afford these issues.
That, and it's just, you know, you could afford the, what are they called, the archives or whatever, the hardcover ones. But, you know, the reprint cost of all these old issues makes it so that they couldn't sell those very cheap, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just that now, at this point, they've kind of made their money back on those and are starting to basically take the work that's already done on these issues and reprint them in paperback and make a little bit money off people that, you know, didn't want to spend the money for the archive edition. So
yeah, the archives are quite expensive and they keep going up. Like, you know, they used to be in the 50s range, now they're like in the 75.
Yeah,
and it's $75 for like 10 issues. That's a lot of fucking money. I mean, it is a nice put together product, but
right. And I think it might have been the guy that used to do the Golden Age of Comics podcast.
Mm-hmm.
I think it might have been him that I heard break it down, or if not, it might have been somewhere else. But, you know, I heard a pretty good breakdown of why they cost that much and, you know, why they can't
remember
really
any of it. Why?
I mean, it's kind of like what I said. It's
having to reproduce material from that old.
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of cases, they don't just have, you know, the original art sitting there, ready, you know, looking good and ready to go. I mean, they have to do a lot of restoration work, and there's a lot of cost in cleaning up the pages and the images to get them ready to the quality, you know, that you see in the end. So, you know, the cost that's involved sort of adds up for them to make their money back and make a profit. I mean, as a business, they have to do it in a way that they're going to at least potentially make a profit. So, yeah, I guess that's the explanation. To me, I mean, I still can't really justify the price for me personally, and that's why, like, I'm excited that these Chronicle issues or these Chronicle books are coming out, because at this point, like I said, the work's already been done for the archive editions. You know, I doubt we'll ever see like a Chronicles volume that it hasn't already been issued as an archives, and you know, at this point they probably figure, okay, the people that are the people that were gonna buy it in the archive edition already have. So let's make some more money off of this work that we did and restoring these and put them out as paperbacks so people like me will pick them up and they get a little extra cash on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And it's cool because they're all in order. It's not like just giving you the Flash. It's giving you Showcase and everything else in between in the order it was published.
Right.
I don't have the Superman ones, and I don't have the Batman ones, but I do have the Green Lantern, Flash, and Wonder Woman.
Which, that pretty much covers the ones that they've that they've done, I think. I don't know if it's come out yet, but I do believe that there's a Justice League one on the way.
They took it off.
Oh, did they?
I just got refunded my money by DCBS. They said they're going to resolicit it at a later time.
Well, I hope they do. I hope it comes out. I have the first two Showcase Presents volumes of Justice League, but, you know, and I like the pencil work. It's sort of interesting to look at it without the colors, but I'd like to see those issues in color.
Mm-hmm. So any kind of retro-style trades besides the Archives and the Chronicles? I think any of the... It depends on how early you want to go. There's a lot of trades that are out that you can pick up if you're interested in that are fairly 90s or 80s. Or I mean, they reprint a lot of stuff. And it also is... I think it depends on what you want on your shelf. Like Chris mentioned, he made a good point. Like, some of the omnibuses and stuff, they're just really bulky, and it depends on how you like to read your books. Like, some of these books are just so freaking huge, and the paper is so thick that you can't easily, like, hold it up to read. You kind of have to sit it on a table or find some comfortable position to be in, whereas these Chronicles, you could just read like a comic book. You can just sit down and enjoy. And to me, I'll be honest, I like this paper. We're reading the Jack Kirby omnibuses, and that paper is like really nice newsprint paper. And to me, the art pops better on newsprint paper than it does on glossy paper. Like, yeah. Glossy paper might last a little longer and is better, but the art just, if you want to look at art, look at it on newsprint. It looks way better. I can't imagine Kirby art on some of the glossy stuff. I really can't.
Yeah, I have to agree that I like the choice of the paper for the Kirby and the Chronicles volumes. I mean, I think for the, you know, especially for reprints of stuff from this era, I think it's the right choice. I think it would look kind of weird on glossy paper. But
hard to read under light, too, depending on, like, if you have a night light to read under or something like that. The gloss reflects the light off the paper, whereas you read this, you don't have that problem.
Right. Yeah, I mean, my general approach is, you know, I'm not a big collector of high-priced books. I mean, I'll spend a little bit on stuff that, you know, is our favorites of mine, like picking up the back issues on those issues of New Teen Titans and stuff, which weren't terribly expensive. But generally, you know, I'll go with stuff in trades unless it's available at a real cheap price. And then I'll go with single issues. Like I said, I like to look at the ads and at the letter columns and stuff. Also, I mean, sometimes it is nice to have a trade for the convenience, as long as the size is not too big. You know, like Mike was just saying, when it comes to some of the omnibus, if that's the only way I can read those issues, but otherwise, I tend to read, even when I'm not in bed, I tend to read like stretched out, laying down on the couch or the futon or something. And like I can remember trying to read that New Teen Titans omnibus in bed. And
you almost hurt yourself.
Yeah, almost giving myself like a bloody nose. Because I usually drop my comic like 3 or 4 times before I actually turn off the light and go to bed, and dropping that comic was like dropping that
on your face. Almost crushed like, you.
Knock myself out instead of actually falling asleep.
I'm guilty of buying the thick omnibuses, but I'll only do it for the old stuff. Like, I won't buy a thick omnibus of Atlantis Attacks or something like that. Mm-hmm. I'll only buy it for, like, if I want Amazing Spider-Man or Fantastic Four 1 through 50 or something like that.
Yeah.
Which I am dying to get into, because there's this this page I follow. It's like Kirby something or another, Kirby Verse, and they, like, post all these Fantastic Four covers in French and all this stuff. And I'm like, God, I want to read that. The covers are just so freaking awesome. And yeah, I've dipped my toe into a lot of Fantastic Four, but not a lot of the early stuff. Like, I've read issue one probably like 10 times, and I've read a lot of the Inhumans issues because I just love the Inhumans, but man, it makes me hungry to read that because the art is just so awesome. Especially yeah. We have a question later, but I really want to read the Galactus and Silver Surfer stuff. I really, really hungry to read that now.
Yeah, I'm curious about, I'm like you, I've read some of the first couple issues of Fantastic Four numerous times, and then there's a real, you know, large bulk of the Lee and Kirby run that I haven't read. And, you know, like Kirby's stuff from the early 60s looks a little bit different than his stuff from the 70s. And I really like the way that his style was very refined in the 70s. But, you know, when you see some of the older, you know, some of the later issues in the run on Fantastic Four, you know, it has that style. Probably what you're talking about, like the Galactus and Silver Surfer stuff. So I would like to take a look at those sometime myself.
Yeah, I'm excited to get into those. Plus, I even want to get into his romance one. That's the one I'm going to target next. And then when I was at one comic shop, I was at this comic shop downtown that has a lot of indie books. Mm-hmm. And I was just looking for print copies of Todd, the Ugliest Kid on Earth, because I just find that book like so fascinating. Like, I love that book. And I just wanted to get some second prints of it. That way I have it in print because I read them digitally.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran across a Kirby and Simon crime book. And I wanted it really bad. But I have a hard time paying for archives at full price. Like, when I know I can try to get it on Amazon or, you know, at 50% or 40%.
Yeah, it is tough. I mean, I like to support shops and stuff when I visit them and buy something and every once in a while. But, I mean, as a consumer, it's just really hard when it comes to the higher the ticket price, the tougher it is to not get it at 50% off, you know? It's one thing buying a single issue of a comic for $3 when you know you can get it for $1.50. It's another thing buying like an omnibus for $100 when you know you can get it for $50, you know?
Yeah.
So.
And you're guaranteed when you get it at 50%, if you ever fall in hard times or you want to get rid of it, you're going to at least make your money back.
Right.
If not more, because a lot of these things do go out of print.
Yeah. So, it's tough. So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of more of a philosophy of how we go about mixing single issues and trades and stuff like that. But I really like the Chronicles series for DC, and Marvel's kind of started to do the same thing too with printing trade versions of their Marvel Masterworks series.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, in order to make a recommendation, I'd need to know what you like. I'd throw all the Kirby stuff at you because that's what I like. But I know a lot about comics and in general that I can recommend almost anything. But I need to know what somebody likes.
Yeah.
If you like history, these books are great because I do feel that some of these books, in order to enjoy them, you have to have a sense of wanting to learn about these characters and how they were created and how they came to be and the history of these characters.
Yeah.
And if you're just like reading all the popular like Vertigo series and stuff, this might be a shock to your system, like, because it's not the same. And if you go into Silver Age and Golden Age, God, there's a big difference. Golden Age is dense as hell, and it's kind of a dry read, in my opinion. It's the least of my favorite of the ages because, not because I don't appreciate it. I want to explore it more from the historical perspective, but it's just a different time for me. And then Silver Age, I think things started to get fun. And then Bronze Age blew me away. I mean, because that's when I was a kid. I mean, that's when I was picking comics off the spinner rack. That's my age as far as like what I'd go to historically. And Chris, you'd probably even go a decade after that. I keep forgetting what they call the modern age. Like, I don't know. Maybe it is called the modern age or the platinum age or whatever the hell it is. But there is an age after the Bronze Age.
Yeah, I mean, for the longest time they did call it the modern age, but
it's like it was spawned around the time of the Image and stuff forming and Valiant, and it was like a new birth of comics where a lot of new companies spawned out.
Yeah, I think I kind of see it as like, for me personally, my definition, I kind of look at, the mid-80s, like post-crisis, when you had Dark Knight Rises and Watchmen stuff coming in, as kind of a demarcation there. And you did have the beginning of precursors to Image and Valiant and stuff. And then, I don't know, I mean, I think it's difficult at this point and sort of inaccurate, I think, to call it the modern age still, and to take what we're currently in. I really think right now, and, you know, since digital comics have become more prevalent,
it's a new age we're in right now.
Yeah, I really in my mind, I kind of think of it as a digital age, like sort of have at some point in the last few years, like we've moved into a different age that we could call the digital age where, I think there's enough different about comics nowadays, and digital is having enough of an influence on the market and on how comic books are made and written and drawn, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I go back to the 80s a lot. That's what I remember as a kid, and I collect a lot of that stuff. And also, I think, yeah, I mean, it makes sense with the Golden Age. I mean, the farther you go back, the farther away you are from our current sensibilities, or the sensibilities that you, at least the ones that you grew up with. And I think going back, the farther you go back, the more that you have to make an effort as a reader to recognize the cultural, historical context in which the issues were written and created. It was a different time, different culture. People expected different things from their entertainment. Their attention spans were longer. They wanted comics to fill up more of their time because they didn't, might not have been able to afford as many or didn't have as many alternatives for entertainment. Nowadays, comics are competing for so much with so much other stuff, and everything's so accessible at any given time. You can't really just be a passive reader and expect the comics to come to you and appeal to your sensibilities because they're so old. You have to kind of do some work as a reader and think and put yourself in a mindset of what it might have been like to be reading it back at that time.
Yeah. I think it's really important when you pick up a book that you are ready for what you're going to get, because that's when you're going to get the maximum entertainment or value out of your book. That's why I'm fortunate to have enough money to buy so much, because you can look at I read about 40 to 50 comics a week, and mm-hmm. I vary from old stuff to new stuff to Image to Valiant to anything. And I'm fortunate enough to try to... I actually asked myself, what do I feel like reading this morning?
Yeah.
And I think when I know what I'm getting into, I get the maximum enjoyment instead of like trying to force myself to read something I'm not ready for. So I have to be prepared when I get into a Golden Age book. Silver Age, even Silver Age a little bit. Bronze Age, I could just jump in at any time. I mean, because that's my age, and pretty much anything from bronze forward, I could just jump into. It's genres and stuff that I like. Right now, I'm like fascinated with romance comics. I'm like, this is fucking interesting, because it's describing a period of time where girls are reading comics. It's fucking insane. And girls are treated differently. And this book that I'm going to cover today is in the 70s. And just reading the letters pages just blew my fucking mind. I mean, I just was blown away by what was said there, because I didn't expect it to be. But I find whatever I love shit. Like, the other thing that I read the hell out of was the Ninjak hardcover. This, oh god, it was so good. I got sucked into that. I felt like I was in the 90s again when Valiant was. I just, like, didn't know what my surroundings were. I was sucked into the world, and I couldn't even hear anything if you try to make noise, because I was just so into the comic book. But I think if you go in with the right mindset into whatever you're going to read, or you pick it when you want to read it, like you feel like reading Flash, you're going to get the maximum entertainment out of it at that point.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, you're a good example of someone, I think, when somebody that's deep enough into a particular fandom has enough interest to go back. I mean, even someone that's into comics that, you know, is maybe into like a lot of other things, you know, but for you, comic books are your main hobby, you know, and so you have the interest to go back and check out, you know, different eras of comics and different styles and genres of comics that, you know, you might not be looking at something that's your ultimate favorite overall, but you're interested in just checking out what other types of comics are like. And I think you see that with people that are, you know, really into one particular genre of, like, somebody that's into movies as a fan of movies in general. They're not just going to see, you know, a random movie, whatever happens to be playing that weekend. They're going back and watching stuff from, you know, different eras of cinema, and like checking things out, and are interested in like the history of movies in general, you know?
Yeah. But these are good questions. These are questions I really like to answer, because I will. And then the next question he asks are, will we ever cover any Golden Age? And I'm sure we will. We talked about Batman. You got Batman Archives on your shelf.
Yeah, I have a couple of the Chronicles volumes, and yeah, I mean, for me, it's the same thing with the Golden Age. That's the farthest back in history, and that's the most effort I have to make when it comes to reading a comic. I mean, if I'm tired or I'm just looking for something that's kind of a mindless read, I'm not going to pick up something from the 40s, you know.
Yeah, you don't want to read that. That's not good, like, right before bed decompression material, right? Because you have to absorb it, you have to at least concentrate on it, and you have to pay respect to it, I mean, for what it is. And I think if you read it while you're passing out, it's just going to help you pass out a little far easier. But yeah. I personally, before bed, I like the mindless entertainment where I don't have to think at all. Like, it's just an average comic, and it's something that I can read really quick and think about a little bit, and then crash out and hopefully not think about work. That's what I do, is when I try to decompress, is I try to escape into a world and then go to bed and then wake up in the morning and get ready for work.
Yeah.
I can read some stories, but I would like to delve into Golden Age, because that's by far my weakest. And I will say that, like, one way to get into back issues is to read about it. Like, if you pick up an issue of Back Issue magazine and you're like, man, I didn't know about this, or I'm interested about this, or I'm interested about this creator, that's like the best material, because you get background in there from somebody else's perspective. You get art from that time period, and you're like, holy crap. Like, if you want to explore the Golden Age or the earlier age, you want to get into Alter Ego, which I have a harder time reading that magazine, just because I don't relate to that material as much. But when I get into this latest back issue, I was like freaking blown away. I was in heaven. It was about backup features in comics. Like, it's about Dr. Fate and the Flash. It's about Jason Bard in freaking Detective Comics. It's about Manhunter. It's about all these characters that never had features of their own that appeared in the back of other comics.
Yeah.
It's like, God, this is heaven. This is like, and it's all DC. I hate to say that, but I love Marvel, but for some reason DC is just that's my thing. But I do read Back Issue magazine, and like the last article I read was about Man-Wolf, which is a Marvel character, which is J. Jonah Jameson's son, goes to the moon and gets this stone and becomes a wolf. And this article just blew me away because he didn't have that much appearances, but they did a lot with him, and he started appearing creatures from the loose, and he went into space, and it was like a space fantasy for a while. Then he comes back to Earth, and it's like, man, it's like stuff that if I see those issues in a back issue bin for a good price, I want to read that. So it's like articles like that, you know, set off my excitement, and I'll look for him on the walls, or I'll look for him in the bins. And if I see him, I'll say, hey, I want to read some more Man-Wolf.
Yeah. You know, that brings up a good point about back issue and alter ego. You know, when I talk about doing work as a reader, being an active reader, I mean, sometimes that just means having the right mental state, but also sometimes it means, like, literally, you know, if you're interested in the history, seek out, you know, the magazines that cover the history or books that cover the history. And, you know, even if you just pick up a random issue and then decide to check out what that issue is, the articles in that issue are talking about, you know, that can sometimes help you to gain a deeper appreciation. You know, if like you go into something you might not be, that's outside of your comfort era, even if it's, you know, whether it's because of the time that it was written or just the genre or the style, sometimes a little education can help us to understand where that comic's coming from and where what the creators were kind of trying to do, and that background information can help us to get more out of it if we want to expand our reading, you know.
And if you read a letters page and you say, well, this guy's from New York, I'm going to ask him what contest he entered and what he won.
Yeah, you never know. You can investigate members of your own community.
You could become a private investigator. Like Chris. But, yeah, this is, I don't know, comics are exciting. And, man, if I could do it for a living, like become a historian of comics, I would love to do that.
You could move to California and...
Well, it's basically... It's basically if I could retire
yeah.
and just do it for fun, like 24/7, that would be like awesome, because...
Totally.
And I would love to discover everything I could possibly understand about Jack Kirby, like see every piece of art, discover more about the person, interview his kids and his every relative I could possibly talk to, because the guy's amazing. I mean,
yeah,
he was like a, I don't know, he just had so much ideas, and I don't think Marvel would be what it is today without him. I really don't.
No.
And the next question we got, which Batman do you like best? Golden Age, Silver Age, Bronze Age, or New 52? Or I guess you could say Modern Age, too. Where you'd go with, like, Dark Knight Returns and Batman Year One. That's definitely a Bronze Age.
Right.
I would say whatever the Modern Age, it probably has changed names, and I just haven't done the research, but I like the Modern Age the best, especially, like, the Detective Comics, with the Alan Grant and Breyfogle art. I mean, that was like when Batman was the best for me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was the Batman I wanted to read. Now I want to delve more into the Silver Age stuff. and even the Golden Age, because I did buy some really old Golden Age comics, but I don't think I want to read those. I'll go get the Chronicles.
Yeah. Yeah, I probably would have to agree. I mean, for me, in some ways, I mean, obviously you can break it down even further. There's so many variations of Batman, but I mean, the modern era, you know, the 80s, between the 80s and early 2000s, really one of my favorite depictions of Batman, sort of like a quintessential, in my mind, characterization is, you know, from the animated series. You know, I really like sort of the balance they... that sometimes, you know, in the modern era, sometimes they would go almost too far in making Batman the brooding loner, you know?
Yeah.
I sort of prefer him to not get that far.
Something, you know, in between.
Yeah. To not take it so far that he's just an asshole to everybody around him. I still like to see... I know I don't want him, like, dancing around happy all the time either, but something sort of in between where you do see a sign that he, you know, cares about, you know, whether it be Robin or Batgirl or whoever, you know, the people that he's working with. It's probably, I find other eras interesting, but it's mostly like, you know, in contrast, like when I go back and I read the Golden Age Batman, part of my enjoyment is just coming from contrasting it with what I sort of think of as Batman in my mind, you know?
Mm-hmm. I will say that for me personally, Batman is the easiest character to get right in any age. I mean, for me to, like, enjoy...
Mm-hmm.
There's some characters where I just have a hard time reading, but Batman, with the exception of, I've only read a couple of Golden Age, I think just the most popular issues, like his first appearance and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else I've really enjoyed. And even in the New 52, I think they do Batman really well. Like, Batman to me, or any of the Bat books, are usually a 4 out of 5 for me. Like, I'll sit and enjoy any of the Bat family books. I even like Batwing quite a bit. And that book doesn't sell very well.
Is how far are they into, like, I kind of get mixed up with, you know, what's current and what's been solicited and stuff like that. How, if I'm not reading it, what... Like, I know they're introducing a new Batwing. Has that happened yet? Or
yeah, the new Batwing is he's closer to the Bat family. I mean, do you want me to say who it is?
I don't mind. Yeah,
it's Lucius Fox's son.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so nice. closer to home. Mm-hmm. Let's just say, and it continues to be a really good book. Like, I've enjoyed it from the beginning. I do enjoy Batgirl by Gail Simone. I enjoy Hurwitz on The Dark Knight. I like Batman a lot. It's probably the best one for me. And Detective is really growing on me. Detective has that lighter sensibility to it that Chris is talking about, I think. You know, that where it's more focused on his detective work and his villains and stuff, and it's a little more modern age than the brooding, dark Batman that we see a lot in the Snyder.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little more lighthearted.
Yeah.
And Batwoman is... A lot of people dropped off, but when I read that one in bulk, and maybe it's because I read it, bulk, it, like, 8 issues, I really enjoyed it.
Mm.
I can see monthly it'd be a disaster because
yeah,
they're long ass stories, and when I read 8 issues in a row, I was like, this is really good. I'm glad I could sit down in an hour or so and read all of these rather than read them, wait a month, read it, wait a month, and then I'd not care as much.
I could see that. I know that that storyline where Williams wasn't doing the art. I mean, each issue, as I was reading them monthly, I found myself following it less and less and caring less and less about what was going on. And I love Batwoman as a character. I think she's awesome. I mean, one of my favorite stories of, you know, recent years was the run with Greg Rucka on Detective Comics. Yeah. Really loved that. I just think, I don't know, not that Williams is a bad writer or storyteller. I think he's got some good themes and ideas. I just think it should have read better monthly because it's a monthly comic. Mm-hmm. You know, you can only excuse it so much by how it reads in quick sequence. And I think when you have somebody like Greg Rucka, who has so much experience as a writer, those are the kind of things that when you have a ton of experience, you get a lot better at the craft aspects of.
Yeah, Mark Waid has got it to a science.
Like, oh, yeah.
You read a Mark Waid book, you're going to get value out of every month. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's got it. Probably one of the best at it, I think.
From a technical standpoint, I think he probably is.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Is a great example of that.
And his last and final question is Chris Ivey going to Heroes Con? I think he's going to Heroes Con. That's why he's asking.
Oh. No, I'm still hoping to go to Baltimore Con in September, but someday it would be nice to go.
The DC Noise crew committed to the Heroes Con.
Yeah.
We should all be there unless something happens, but we all have plans to be there.
Yeah, and it sounds like of the two, I mean, if I'm just going to go to the one this year, that would be Baltimore Con would be the greatest opportunity for me to, I mean, I want to go to the convention and like do some like actual convention stuff, but a big part of the motivator behind the trip is to get a chance to like meet podcasters and you know people I talk to on the internet. So
that's the glory of it, really.
Yeah, I mean that's definitely a big part of the motivation.
It is a good time. It is really a good time.
So,
plus if Tom Scholey's at Heroes, you won't see a lot. You'll know where to find me.
Yeah. Following along in his wake. Please, sir. Another sketch.
Oh my god, I'm just like twisted by like if I should start contacting him from now saying I want at least four and can you start them now and I'll send you money. I just that's one of my favorite collections I've been getting from cons or his sketches. I sometimes get others, but my Tom sketches, because they're so Kirby-esque,
yeah,
I'm just obsessed.
Like the next best thing.
Yeah. And we had one other question from Kyle Henry. He just asked if we had any favorite, Happy Meals toys. And I don't remember ever buying Happy Meals. Like, I came from a family that didn't have a lot of money, and we didn't eat out a lot. We really didn't. I mean, the most toys I would get were out of a cereal box, you know, like the things you'd find in cereal. But I don't remember any particular Happy Meal toys that I have or saw.
I'm trying to think of Happy Meal specific, because actually the first thing I thought of was not McDonald's, but Arby's. I don't think I don't even know if they do anything for kids anymore, but back in the day, there was a stretch of time where they had, you would go and they would have little plastic figurines of the Little Miss and Mr. Man or whatever they're called characters. They're like a series of books like Little Miss Sunshine and Mr. Happy, and they had like little plastic figurines of those, and we were collecting those and really liked them.
I think when I was a kid, we had a burger chef in Jeff. And I can't remember.
I never even heard of that.
What the hell this was, but they had collector's glasses. And yeah. Like if you bought a root beer or whatever you bought, you'd get like a DC glass. And like if you go to cons now, they have special companies that actually make these glasses, like newer versions of them.
Yeah.
And you can see them. But when I was a kid, that was my favorite like fast food thing to get with these glasses, because I would, once I'd get the glass, I would drink out of it all the time. I was like, here's Green Lanterns on my freaking glass.
Yeah, that actually, I was just thinking about the whole collected glass thing too. That was a phenomenon I liked when I was a kid too, from fast food restaurants. We used to have a bunch of the they were the Looney Tunes characters. Mm-hmm. I used to love those as a kid. I always wanted to drink out of those. But, I mean, like you said, they're made out of glass, so a lot of them didn't last the time, you know, test the time.
And if you drank out of them a lot, they just get worn, and eventually the paint will... but yeah, that's my favorite, like, fast food thing that I ever did.
Yeah.
And then Vicious Smith sent us one. I always call him Vicious instead of his name, but because it used to be back in the day. Vicious has been listening to Geek Brunch like almost like when me and Heath started it, which is a long freaking time ago. It was like 2006.
Yeah. He was
one of our first listeners, and at the time, he never wanted anybody to know his name. I still call him Vicious. But he asked a very interesting question, and we touched on it just briefly. But he said he wanted us to touch a little bit on the Heralds of Galactus. And,
okay.
I thought that was interesting, and I'd like to, like we just talked about, I'd like to explore some of those early Silver Surfer issues with Galactus. But my Galactus as a kid, I think Terax was the Herald of Galactus. This was during the John Byrne era. And then Frankie, who was dating Johnny at the time, she became the Herald of Galactus. And all the other Heralds of Galactus I knew about, but I didn't really read much about them, like Fire Lord. I've seen him in Annihilation and Airwalker and all those, but what are your experiences with the Heralds?
You know, I did get into Silver Surfer when I was a kid. I thought I was reading something really obscure and weird because, you know, it was so different than a lot of the stuff I was reading. I read the Silver Surfer series for a while when Ron Lim was drawing it, and I really liked his art. I still do appreciate it. And I think it was one of those things where I got an issue or two in like a combo pack or something of Silver Surfer, and I read, you know, the issues and were pretty fascinated by them. And that's kind of where I first got acquainted with Marvel Cosmic stuff. But it's kind of found it fascinating. I think, you know, obviously at the time, I think he was no longer the Herald and was kind of, you know, Thanos showed up a bunch of times. He was dealing with Thanos. And I think before I got out of things, I think I did the Infinity Gauntlet came up, that series. But obviously Silver Surfer is the first thing I think of. But then Fire Lord for me also was probably the next in terms of, to me, he's always just very visually appealing.
Yeah, probably the most visual, the best looking Herald.
Yeah,
his costume and fire and his staff and looks cool.
Yeah, I always found him pretty fascinating visually. I want to go. I don't think I completed the order, but at some point I want to pick those Silver Surfer issues up again because. Really, they're really different. Very, very heavy science fiction. You know, it didn't really deal with or connect back to like Earth events very much. It was very, very heavily focused on outer space and cosmic level threats and stuff like that. And Silver Surfer was such a strange hero and kind of just alien and weird to follow as the protagonist. And you know, he went to a lot of weird planets and dealt with a lot of weird circumstances in that era. I found it pretty fascinating as a kid.
Yeah, I read only a few of those. This is the 90s version of the Silver Surfer, Ron Lim.
Yeah, I believe it was like early 90s, yeah.
It was popular at the time, I remember that. At least the first few issues were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think when it ended up tying into Infinity Gauntlet and stuff, that got a lot of press and attention.
I remember reading Silver Surfer and Secret Origins when I was a teenager, and I was kind of like, who is this weird fucker? Because he's just talking to himself. He's like a philosopher. He'd be on his surfboard and just talking to himself. And at the time, I didn't really understand it much, and I didn't appreciate it much. And now I think I'd get a hell of a lot more out of it.
Yeah, I think a lot of that, especially after reading the Untold Story of Marvel Comics, it really comes across that in the 70s there was a lot of, you know, a lot of the young guys that were working at Marvel, like James Starlin and stuff, took like a very trippy approach to. I mean, they were like running around New York City as like together as a group, like tripping off acid and stuff like that, and then going and writing comic books like based off of their like psychedelic trips and stuff of like Warlock and all that stuff, you know. So it's pretty funny.
Mm-hmm. So you want to jump into the miscellaneous?
Sure.
All right. What do you got for us this week?
I got a couple things. I, for whatever reason, I don't know if it's because the movie's coming out this year, but I found myself thinking about Wolverine and remembering when I used to like Wolverine and when he wasn't so overexposed. I mean, I am interested in the movie this year because they are connecting it to, like, you know, the one thing that could make me interested in a Wolverine movie, with the whole Japan stuff. And so I wanted to read some old Wolverine just to kind of see how it held up and, you know, how it connected with my memories of it and stuff. So I read the first three issues of his first solo series.
The mini one or the ongoing?
First ongoing, yeah.
Okay.
The ongoing.
Where he's got a patch?
Yep. Where he is Patch, yeah.
Yeah.
Calling himself Patch. And this was, you know, was Chris Claremont, of course, and John Buscema. And I don't know if I read these particular issues. I know I definitely read a couple issues down the road from these. I think my own collection started maybe around like 10 or 11. I started buying them. And my buddy in middle school that was my big comic book friend, he had some of the earlier issues. Now it's always like issue 8 was always one of my favorite to look at, and wish that he would trade me, which is the one that has Wolverine and Hulk standing next to each other and tuxes on the cover.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I really like it's, you know, these occurred when the X-Men were thought to be dead. And we're keeping that illusion alive. So we're avoiding the public eye. So Wolverine doesn't appear in costume at all in these issues. And he also doesn't unsheath his claws a lot because he doesn't want to reveal his identity that way. So you get this kind of minimalism as far as his powers go that you don't normally see. The plot line deals with centered around the legendary sword Muramasa, which is a real legend, and there's this cult of the Black Blade that are seeking to obtain it for its powers, And as a result, there's a hijacked plane that's connected to, one of the passengers is connected to Mariko, you know, Wolverine's long Japanese love interest. He's a steward or something of hers, and Wolverine connects the news reports of the hijacked plane to, you know, the fact that Mariko's steward was on it, and goes to try to rescue the guy and stuff. This all occurs in, like, near Indonesia. And also on the plane is Lindsay McHale, who was a roommate of Jessica Drew, who at this time had lost her powers as Spider-Woman, and they were working as private eyes together. So it turns out that Jessica has the blade, that her and Lindsay were going to smuggle it back together. And we also get the Silver Samurai showing up, seeking the blade as well. So you kind of have these different players in the story. And in the second issue, Jessica finally shows up. She's just been talked about, but she shows up possessed by the Muramasa blade. Anyone that actually touches it with their bare hands becomes, their soul becomes possessed by the blade, and their abilities are taken over. Later on in the third issue, at the end of the second issue into the third, Wolverine himself ends up holding the blade and becomes possessed. So, you know, it comes down to Silver Samurai ends up working with Lindsay McHale and a few other people to try to stop Wolverine, you know, possessed by the blade, from sacrificing Jessica Drew, and, like, sort of just, like, finalizing the connection between him and the blade once and for all. And so Lindsay, using a sniper rifle, shoots Wolverine in the head, and, you know, she thinks that she missed later on because he is able to recover from it, but, you know, obviously he recovers from it because of his skeleton and his healing factor and stuff. And they kind of, like, he's able to keep his cover because, you know, he they kind of just put it down to the powers that the blade gives you, you know, the immunity that he displays. But, you know, it lived up. Whether I read these specific issues or just ones nearby, it lived up to my memories of the era. Really like Bushima's art on these. I think it's really suitable to the story, his style. And it reminds me in some ways of, you know, like Master of Kung Fu, where you have, they're almost like 70s, like espionage, like action flicks. Definitely has that kind of feel to it, where the superhero aspects of it are downplayed somewhat. Like I said, Wolverine doesn't appear in costume. The only really, like, Silver Samurai is the only one that really looks superhero-ish, and even he, his outfit is armor. You know, it's like ancient Japanese armor, so it's not really that superhero-y. Mm-hmm. And I say, as far as the storytelling, it's written really well. I mean, the only moment where it really kind of, like, skips a beat, as it were, where it's like to resolve the issue of Wolverine being overpowered by the blade, he just kind of ends up breaking its hold on him through his own willpower, unless I miss something. It happens over just a couple panels that seemed a little, like, rushed. But otherwise, the pacing of the three-issue story was really good. And, you know, it hits a lot of beats. There's, like, a lot of action, and there's, like, some sexy moments, and there's humorous moments. Like, a lot of the latter comes, of those latter two, come from Lindsay, because she's an actress also, and she's trying to keep up with Wolverine. There's a funny scene where the two of them she's trying to keep up with him drinking Long Island iced teas, and she gets pretty drunk. And for, like, half the story, she's recovering from being, like, kind of bombed. So she's, like, hiccuping as she's talking, and she goes to, like, interrogate or talk to somebody, and like burps in their face. So it just like the whole tone of it, just a lot of it just really reminded me of like a cinematic 70s action movie, martial arts movie.
Did you just pull these out of a box to read or what?
No, I read them on Marvel Unlimited.
Oh, okay. They're on available.
Yeah.
Are you liking that Marvel Unlimited? Is it a good deal?
I like it. I don't use it all the time, but it's so cheap. You know, it works out to only like a few dollars a month, but I just keep it active in case the whim hits me. And now it's a little slow at times, but it's gotten even better because before you couldn't, it was all flash based, so you couldn't read it. But you know, on your phone, but now they have an app out for iPhone and iPad now.
Mm-hmm.
So you can even read them that way.
Oh, wow.
There's a shitload of comics on there. I mean, there's nothing like new from like the last like 6 or 7 months.
Yeah.
And it can take them a while to get stuff up on there, but like as far as like anyone that has an interest in back issues and doesn't mind reading them that way, there's tons of stuff on there.
Nice. Is that Lindsay on the cover of number 3?
What's the cover look like again?
It's got somebody shooting Wolverine with the sniper and then a naked girl who's like, it looks like he's ready to stab a naked girl. She's blonde.
Actually,
I don't think it was Jessica Drew because Jessica Drew has black hair.
She does, and she does an issue, but she's got this weird wig on.
Oh, okay. She's got a blonde wig?
Yeah, she's got this like blondish, reddish wig or something.
Because I think you said that Lindsay was the one shooting.
Yeah, she's the one with the sniper rifle. And when Wolverine brings Jessica out to sacrifice her, all she's wearing is like a not a loincloth, but like a long, like you see them a lot in like women, like fantasies. Women like the. It's like a long dress, but it only goes in, you know.
The way Buscema drew it here, it looks like she's naked. Like, totally.
Yeah, and
like her hair is covering their breasts, and then around her waist, her arms are going over her her crotch area, so you can't see if she's wearing anything or not.
Yeah.
And if it's just a lion cloth, her hips don't show any, like, string.
Maybe they added it after the fact. Cause, she can only be topless. This is America, not Canada. That's like...
You know what? I only have the first 7 issues of that series. I guess I don't even remember reading them. I might have just got them and bagged and boarded them because I don't remember reading any Wolverine patch.
Yeah, it's probably my favorite Wolverine era. I mean...
Mine is the 4-issue miniseries, but...
Well, I mean, I would include all, like, from the early minis and Marvel Comic Presents stuff, and then the early part of his solo series when Claremont was writing it. And
yeah.
I even like, I mean, I don't like everything from his entire career, but, like, that was one of the early books that, like, Silvestri worked on.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of took, like, Buscema's style and just, you know, made it a little more angular, but... it was suitable for the book. So, yeah, it was kind of successful in terms of reminding me of a time where I was really into the Wolverine character.
Yeah. That's cool. That's something I'd like to read at some point. Well, I read Girls' Romances 135 from DC Comics. And on the cover, it's got this hippie guy, and he's saying, "You know we can't live without each other," and the girl's crying. And she says, "Oh, Kip, I do love you, but you know my parents feel about you and that crazy hippie life you lead." And this is like showcasing the fact that it's got 3 stories in it. And they all start really depressing, like girls brokenhearted and stuff, and they end up with happy endings. Like this first story was a unique one. This arrogant asshole sports dude gets in a car accident and loses his eyesight, but the doctor says, "You know, I think with surgery we could get your eyesight back, but you're going to be blind for a while." Well, he meets like a therapist that's blind herself that's helping him through this. Mm-hmm. And she falls in love with him and gets him through the ordeal. And then when he goes to get his surgery, she breaks up with him because she's like, once you're going to get your sight back, you're not going to want me, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it ends up happy because he finds her when he has his sight back and they fall in love. The next story is just freaking weird. It's about two girlfriends and one of them's getting married, and it turns out that the guy that she's getting married to used to be a little fling for the other one. And it was interesting because she was getting her gown ready and she said, why don't you just go out with them? And she like goes to meet him and she's like, holy shit, I know you. You took me out that night and told me all this and kissed me and all this. And it turns out they're both, she's married too. So it ended happy. It makes it look like she's going to be the jealous girl, but she's not. Very interesting story. And I don't know who the creators are. There's no creative teams credited for this.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and then this other one's really interesting. It's about this girl who does a dull 9-to-5 job, you know, typing all day, and she hates her life, and she's with this dude she absolutely hates, and mm-hmm. she goes, he's so horrible, I can't wait to get home. That's how bad his company is. And then when he kisses her goodbye, I even hate his kisses. So she decided to take a trip to France. And she meets this like photographer there that's American that like has her model and all the stuff. And she falls in love with him but doesn't think he's going to reciprocate. And when she leaves, he kind of just shakes her hand and kisses her on the cheek and says, you know, it was good being with you. And then as she's leaving, he comes back and says, I love you. I can't let you leave. And then there's a whole letters page. And this is interesting. This is called Julia Roberts Romance Counselor. And I'm just going to read the first one, but they're all kind of interesting little articles. This first one is, put yourself in the 19. This is 1968, a year before I was born.
Mm-hmm.
As she says, I am 16 years old and I'm going steady. My boyfriend is 19 years old. This is interesting. And he's the leader of a band. I love him. The trouble is, one of the other players in the band is a boyfriend I used to have. So she's a groupie. Whoa. And the trouble is, I think I still have feelings for him too. My boyfriend suspects this, but he hasn't said anything about it to me. Every time I see the other boy, I feel like I'm going to faint. I don't know if it's love, but it sure feels like it. Please tell me what to do. Am I being disloyal to my present boyfriend? Should I have it out with the boyfriend I used to have? And if he still likes me, then break it off with my current boyfriend? And then she signs it confused. And Miss Julia Roberts says, You are certainly a practical girl. In answer to one of your questions, yes, you are being disloyal. Worse, unfair to your present boyfriend. Considering the way you feel about your old boyfriend, I suggest you break it off with your present boyfriend right now, whether you get anywhere with your old boyfriend or not. It's the only fair way to act. I just think this is great. This is like love letters, and they're all like 14-year-old girls that are writing these things.
Yeah.
This is crazy shit. And then we get the final, what was on the cover, the hippie story, and which was the best story of all of them. She's basically trying to gear him. He's like, he doesn't want to do anything with his life. He just wants to play guitar and get gigs, and he's like, seems like he's almost homeless. And she's trying to get him jobs and stuff, and her parents like don't want him anywhere near her, and they're going to ship her off to school because they don't want him. And it's to be continued. And what are my chances of finding Girls' Romances 136? I don't know. I don't know how that story is going to end. But this was very fun. This was like hilarious. They were all really well-written stories. The letters page, there was like several other letters. I found it weird that there was a groupie in 1968 that was 16 years old and had two dudes in the band.
Yeah. How did you end up with that issue?
This one I got from my brother. I'm going to sell a lot of his collection, but there was a handful of them I wanted to keep.
Uh-huh.
And this was one of them. I am going to seek out... These are hilarious covers. I mean, Romance from DC, the covers are just hilarious. And they're good reads. They actually are. You get sucked into these little soap operas.
Well, and that has a connection to Kirby, too.
Yeah, least, I want to seek those out. So, do you got any more?
I have one more thing. It's four issues, but it's four-issue mini. I finished up reading America versus the Justice Society.
Oh, nice.
Speaking of long, I mean, these are some long issues. They're from the 80s, but, you know, Roy Thomas writes, he's a lover of the Golden Age, and you can tell just in how dense the writing is. it's not a complaint, but just an observation. And these are, I mean, Roy Thomas is, nowadays, I mean, that's pretty much what he is a historian of comics. I mean, but he, even when he was a writer of them regularly, you know, he was one as well, and, you know, creator of Alter Ego, still the editor of the magazine. And each one of these issues, the inside, front, and back cover are footnotes that tell you, so the, you know, the storyline basically is that the Justice Society is standing before a congressional hearing, being investigated, and so there's a lot of recounting of events from the Justice Society. I don't know if I said League a minute ago, but JSA history. And so the footnotes tell you, you know, what original All-Star Comics issues that the events were depicted in, and some, you know, additional notes. And then there's also checklists of, you know, appearances by some of the JSAers outside of, like, Golden Age appearances outside of All-Star Comics, you know, their solo adventures. So definitely a nice reference for any kind of, like, students of the team and their history and stuff. But yeah, the main gist of things is that so this all, of course, occurs on Earth 2. And when the story starts, Batman on Earth 2 is dead. And has been dead for a few years, and a journal turns up, supposedly written by him, that accuses the JSA of treason. It alleges that back in World War II, most of the members, I think minus Superman, that were active at the time, secretly pledged allegiance to Hitler and were working as double agents all this time. So you get kind of, so the journal ends up in Clark Kent's hand, and on Earth 2, Clark Kent is the you know, he runs the paper. He's not just a reporter at this point, he's the chief. And he wrestles with his journalistic you know, his journalistic responsibilities and his secret identity as Superman and friend and one-time member of the JSA, and ultimately decides to publish it, but, you know, throughout the story, continues to have mixed feelings about the decision and feels bad about it, even though, you know, his teammates and stuff don't really blame him for doing so. And eventually we get, when they sit on, they sit in the hearings, we end up with Helena Wayne, Huntress, and Batman's daughter.
That was weird.
Yeah.
I just lost you when you were talking about Helena Wayne.
Yeah. Skype was trying to tell me to get on with it. No, so basically what we have is Helena Wayne up against Dick Grayson as lawyers. They're both lawyers in Earth 2. And we actually get to a point in issue 3, which is kind of interesting, where the two of them have a conversation. They're both kind of torn by the situation and really torn up by what it could mean for Batman's reputation. Bruce Wayne, before he died, was the commissioner of police and was starting to lose it a little bit mentally and started to have kind of a grudge against the JSA. But like Dick is conflicted because he doesn't want Batman's reputation to be tarnished. And, you know, if the journal turns out to be untrue, that means it would reflect badly on Bruce Wayne, that he was a crazy person or that he was accusing his friends of being traitors. But, you know, the flip side, and for Helena, the thing is like, nobody's perfect, even my father. And, you know, I won't sit here and, you know, allow these heroes to be accused of treason, even if it's by, you know, my father's diary. So it's kind of like you can see the, like, I thought it was executed pretty well because you could see both of their points of view and where they're coming from and how they're torn by the situation. And Dick's afraid that Helena is going to reveal that Bruce Wayne and Batman are the same person, because the world just thinks that they happen to die on the same day. And you know, she doesn't want to, but she's questioning herself and wondering if she's willing to, if it comes to that, if she has to. Like I said, I mean, there's a lot of, if you're interested in, you know, JSA history and what they did in the Golden Age, there's a lot of recapping of their adventures. As you go through the hearings, they take turns talking about, you know, their former adventures, kind of going through chronologically from the beginning of the Justice Society to what was then present day. You know, mostly focusing on the like 40s, 50s, and 60s. As you get towards the end, you know, Jay Garrick talks a little bit about them coming back, you know, in the silver, and what we know as the Silver Age. And there's a lot of like cool tidbits, like the hearing questions them about the disappearance of like members Uncle Sam, the Freedom Fighters. You know, and it's funny because there's a number of times where they're trying to explain the fact that there's multiple Earths, and they're talking about time travel and like the courtroom is kind of like reacting to how crazy some of the stuff that they're talking about is, and sort of what's kind of behind it. I won't reveal the end because there's some nice moments at the end, but basically the you know, it ties into the 50s and when the JSA disbanded until the Silver Age, in front of the House on Congressional Committee, and the guy that took McCarthy's place was the one that kind of like was going to force them to unmask, you know, so they decided to just disappear. His son now runs the paper in Washington, D.C., and he blames them for his father's death. His father ended up in a fire years after that, and he blames the JSA. So he is the one that's kind of like motivated to push this whole political process through and get them branded as traitors.
Is it because his father died of in a fire because of the JSA?
He feels that it's because of the JSA, but later another character, you know, kind of calls him out on it and says, you know, you're the only one in the world that thinks that the JSA are to blame. Everyone, you know, knows that it was just an accident, and had nothing to do with them. So he's kind of the motivator behind it. But like some other players from the JSA's past get involved. And, you know, kind of as Roy Thomas is wont to do, you know, ties into past and present, kind of brings everything sort of full circle. You know, I enjoyed it a lot just because I like the JSA history, and I haven't read a lot of the Golden Age stuff, so it gives you a good overview of that.
A lot of that happened in Adventure Comics, which was in Golden Age, like the death of Bruce Wayne.
Yeah, like, I mean, it goes through a lot of the Golden Age stuff, but it does catch up with, you know, when All-Star Comics returned and Adventure Comics and stuff like the mm-hmm. recent events. It treats, you know, it's at this point, this is pre-Crisis, like right around the time of Crisis, so it's kind of right before that. I mean, you have appearances of Infinity Inc., because they're kind of like hanging out together and watching the proceedings on the television and wishing they were down there helping. You have like Sandman is there, but like they're all like kind of cautioning him not to speak too much because he had recently had his third stroke. So it's kind of funny at the end, like the characters take turns doing the talking. And towards the end, when they're talking about more recent events, Power Girl all of a sudden shows up by just like blasting her way through one of the walls of the courtroom, right past two military police, and one of them's thinking, "Well, so much for our new security precautions." So,
no boob window, huh?
Right. Yeah. So it's like the
pre-boob window.
Yeah, she's got the white leotard with the red cape,
yeah,
and the blue gloves and boots. But it's really like a smorgasbord of like Earth 2 history and like JSA concepts and stuff. Up to, I think it was kind of conceived. It was at this point, you know, there's a little introduction at the first issue that Roy Thomas writes that he's wanted to for years write a history of the Justice Society of America. It's like four issues that are 48 pages. For the first one's 48 pages, and then 2, 3, and 4 are 32 pages. And they're really packed. So it's a way of like having a framing story that turns out to be still pretty interesting. But in the meantime, you know, they take the space to recount and give you a pretty thorough overview of all of the Justice Society's history from their beginning to, like, the early 80s.
Yeah, so. I don't remember reading that. I have it, but I don't remember it at all.
So, yeah, it's pretty cool. I mean,
did you read a trade on that, or is it the issues?
No, I have the issues.
Okay.
I believe I picked them up pretty cheap at some point.
Listener asked us to cover that one. I don't remember who it was, but...
I think it was William.
Oh, was it?
I believe, you know, he really likes
the JSA. That kind of
stuff. Yeah, like... heroes from like the 40s and 50s, like JSA and the Defenders and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, my last book is I finished the Blackwater Ninjak, which is part of the Valiant Master series, which these hardcovers are amazing. And Ninjak was really, really popular at the time because Quesada was drawing it. The writer was Mark Moretti. This guy I don't know much about, like, but he was a talented dude because he drew too. Like later in the issues, he was the writer and penciler, and
he
drew a hell of a comic. He was not a Quesada, but he drew damn well. Like I didn't notice too much of a difference other than a lot of splash pages and the details of Ninjak kind of simmered down a little bit. But this is a great freaking book. At the end of issue 2, which I've covered in a previous episode, you thought Dr. Silk and his clan had drowned to death and died. Well, it turns out that's not the case, but before we get to that, we get to a story where he's kind of like separate. He thinks he destroyed Dr. Silk, and he's kind of like on his own, and he hooks up with Colonel Alcott, or Neville, who's like in London. He's that secret spy agency that actually assigns Bloodshot to activities, and he's now trying to get involved with Ninjak. And he sends him to Japan, and there's a lot of history there. He sends him because the daughter of this guy named Akubo-san, who's a senator out there, has a daughter, Machiko, who they've had a previous relationship with. And at this time, you do not know the history of this relationship. But when you get to the origin issues in issue 0 and 00, issue 00, you get all that stuff, and it makes the story even more rich and refined and fantastic. But that senator is involved with the Yakuza, and they're going to go after his daughter. And he gets sent there to protect her, and obviously he's going to protect her because he used to love her. And what else happens? And they end up in a safe shelter, and there's this dude that also gets refined called the Seventh Dragon. His name is Shotaro Ishimatsu. I can't pronounce it, but he's a badass fighter too. And he used to be in love with Machiko as well, but he is always rejected because she still has fond memories of Ninjak. And but anyway, the adventure ends, and those two actually team up to take down the Yakuza. And he thinks he's going to live with Machiko again, but she says, "I can't be with you anymore because my father doesn't want you because you're, you know, a white dude." And he also is dying of cancer, and he wants me to have kids, so I have to be with somebody else. So it kind of ends that relationship. And then you get a two-issue story arc with Ninjak and Exo Man of War. They're on the same side, but it's misunderstandings, and they end up fighting each other. But he's actually trying to help Orb take down Dr. Silk, because Dr. Silk is attacking Orb Industries, which is Exo Man of War's company. He's attacking it because he knows about the armor, and it's something that can... Dr. Silk is in a wheelchair, and he's withering away, and he knows that armor could keep him alive, so he wants to get that armor, and he captured a spider alien to tell him all this, and they end up fighting and throwing it out, and they take down Dr. Silk again, but he gets away. And then you get Zero and issues 0.0, which tell you the history of it, and I didn't remember the history of Ninjak, but it's awesome. It's his father used to be an agent, and they wanted him to find a mate, so he found this blonde girl who was real rich, and kind of she seems kind of spoiled, and he was just going to mate with her while they inject her while she's pregnant with like super soldier serum, if you will, and and Colonel Alcott with his wife decided to do the same thing, and he has Julian, who's always the one that's wheeling Alcott around, so they're really like super soldiers. Like, they have these serums in them that make them above and beyond like regular people. And I found that fascinating, and the fact that Julian, who I've been reading a lot in Bloodshot, has also got that serum in her. And you get the origin of Dr. Silk, which is a lot like Dr. Octopus now that I'm reading Superior Spider-Man. it's very similar. His father was very abusive and treated him like shit, and he's a very sickly man. He's always been ill, but he acquires companies and forms this network like a spider web, and he takes over companies behind the scenes, and he's got an evil agenda. And but man, this story is good stuff, man. this was like, I got sucked into this world of Ninjak and I didn't want to put it down. I was like, where's the next hardcover? I wanted to read it.
Yeah.
It was great. And they killed his father, like, in front of him when he was a kid growing up. Like, the one villain in Japan killed him because he knew he was a spy, like a British spy. And he was going to kill the son, too, because he was a villain that doesn't shit around. That was like, I don't want to have some son later on in life come and have his vengeance against me. I'm going to kill him now. But he ended up getting away because there were two people in his organization that were spies as well that raised him. They always call him Dog because he's not of their race, and they treat him like a dog, but they're really training him to be one of the best fighters on the planet. It is a cool story. I wish that there'd be more of these older books. Like, now that they're going to launch Quantum and Woody, I want a Quantum and Woody hardcover. And I want, like, the next volume to Bloodshot, and the next volume to Ninjak, and the next XO Manowar, and the next Harbinger, and the next Archer and Armstrong. I just want to keep reading them. And I want them on my shelf because they're nice hardcovers. They're real, like, you talk about good hardcovers, and you talk about readability. Mm-hmm. Like, they're regular size. It's like the size of a comic book. And it's a hardcover that size, and it's a great size to, like, read. Nice.
Do you know how those have been selling at all, or?
Probably not well. I haven't heard much, but I am going to ping them either at the con or on Facebook and say, you got any other hardcovers? The next hardcover that's coming out is Shadow Man.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm currently reading, I started that this weekend as well, the new series, the 2012 started series, and that's amazing.
Yeah, I read the, I'm behind, but I've been continuing to buy all the Valiant issues. I did read the first couple issues of Shadow Man. I thought they were really good.
Issue one was a good issue. Like, it gave you everything you needed about this universe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a really solid first issue.
Solid first issue, and issues two and three were really good. They weren't as good as issue one, but they're still like 4 out of 5s for me. And I'm looking forward to reading the old one. It's different because he's not a sax player like in the old universe. He's a curator at a museum that kind of is like a handyman that does everything. And he actually had a private investigator, you know, go find out about his parents, and he thinks they're bad parents, decides to throw this artifact he has around his neck that his mom gave him, and they abandoned him, so he grew up an orphan. He throws it away into the ocean, which was a bad idea, because that set the Loa on him to become the next Shadow Man, and also let Master Dark know he was out there. And God, it's good stuff. I love the Valiant universe. It's so rich, and it's like subtle things that they show in the art, like a picture with Neville and his daughter and Ninjak's dad appear early in the issue, and you're like, why do they have this picture on the desk? And you read like 8 issues later, and you understand where that picture was taken, and you're like, just subtle things like that, it just makes it amazing. And tightly knit, and the way they did everything is just great. I want more, man. I want more now.
I mean, I like the new Valiant. I feel like I'm getting a condensed, controlled continuity superhero universe that, DC and Marvel have gotten too big to present.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm actually triple dipping in the Valiant stuff, because I get the trades, I get the monthlies, and then I also usually buy the digital. When they have those digital sales, I like have them all, so it's like I'm a Valiant freak.
Well, as someone who's enjoying the new books, I appreciate you helping keep them in business.
I'm trying. And these hardcovers, well, I guess they're kind of expensive. They're $25.
Is that like, retail or
issues? That's
overpriced. I mean,
retail you usually get it for 40 or 50% off through DCBS. So it's not bad if you throw in your discount.
No, that's not bad. No, I mean, especially if you. I mean, Valiant's weird. It's like some issues are hyper available, and then others, like, you know, you might have to be okay with only having one kidney for the rest of your life if you want them. So it can be kind of hard to get a whole collection of the old Valiant. So hopefully they'll keep... It doesn't seem like... What do they do? A few of those a year, it seems like?
They've been launching one every 3 months. And, but that's since... I don't know where they're... They haven't solicited anything like a second one, like a second volume. Everything's been first volume.
Right.
But they have so much to explore. Like, right. I really hope the next character is like Eternal Warrior... Or I hope we get a Eternal Warrior series or a Ninjak series, because Ninjak's just been in not his own book, but I would imagine since they released this hardcover, he's going to have a series soon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're trying to, like, this is what Ninjak's about, and at least was about, because they do tweak the origins slightly.
Yeah. Yeah, he was. Primarily in Exo Manowar, right?
Yeah. He had a good fight with Exo Manowar once he got his armor. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've seen Iron Man 3 yet. Have you seen that?
Mm-mm. No.
His armor has a similar feature to RX now. Like where he can just have it floating around kind of thing.
Isn't that the whole... like extremist thing from the comics or
I thought the extremist was more like it's in a system, like
this is like external to him.
I don't want to give too much away because it's a really good movie, at least I think it is.
Yeah,
Daryl's pouting about it, the big baby, he hasn't even watched it yet.
What without spoiling anything for anybody, I mean, is there a basic gist to the... Because I've seen more than one person sort of be disappointed by it and kind of surprised. I don't know if there's like a...
There's a thing to be disappointed about if you're a fan of something, but the way they execute it... Like, when you go to these movies, unless you're going to like a 300 or Watchmen, you could expect it to deviate from a comic book.
Sure.
Because they have to appeal to the mass audience. And they do something with a character that I think is really well done for the mass audience. And I guess fans of the comic book might be upset with, but for me it was... I don't want to give that away because that's what the part of the glory of the movie, I think, is.
Okay.
But it's a good... I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great. Of course, I love everything, so I don't... listen to me.
No, but I think... It's a tough balance to get right. I mean, I think Avengers was probably one of the best examples of that ever, where they just managed to hit that balance almost perfectly between making, you know, the hardcore fans... happy, but also maintaining broad appeal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a kind of a tough thing to pull off. A lot of other comic book movies err on one side or the other. You know, it's hard to pull off. For me, as long as it, you know, not just change things for stupid reasons and it works in the context of the story. As long as it's fairly faithful just to, like, the spirit of the comic, I'm okay. You know, it's just, like, one of the things that, like, with some, like, examples where they get too caught up in Hollywoodizing it and trying to, you know, they eschew, like, too much of the comic book and the spirit of it.
Yeah.
It starts to, and a lot of times those ones don't do that well. I mean, like the Fantastic Four movies.
They did mediocre, I think.
Yeah, and it's like sometimes
they weren't like a Green Lantern flop, but
yeah.
I wish Marvel would get that franchise back, the Fantastic Four. I wish they'd get the, although the X-Men franchise I think has done fairly well on its own with 20th Century Fox.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I would rather have a cohesive universe. It would be awesome to have the X-Men involved.
I think X-Men and Spider-Man have done okay, but it's good that they got Daredevil back. And
yeah, Daredevil flopped, and I really enjoyed it. I don't know why I like it so much, but I do.
You know, I didn't love it, but I they did.
I loved Bullseye. I loved what they did with Elektra in that movie.
Yeah, she didn't. I was a big fan of hers from Alias, but I didn't think she really made too much sense as Elektra.
Hmm.
But the director's cut of it was a little bit better, though. It made a little more sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, Fantastic Four, I just think, I don't know, the rumors about the casting so far have been a little disconcerting, and I just feel like that's a movie that, until they are more faithful to the spirit of the comic book itself, and what makes
they don't get it.
Yeah, it's just they're not going to be successful, even with like your people that aren't big fans. You know, if it's still not going to go across with them really well if you're presenting something stripped of what makes it, like, has made it a success for over half a century. You know.
Yeah, in this case, I really dug it. Once you see it, we'll have to talk. We'll have to at least talk about it, because I'll be interested. Because the at least the people that I've chatted with that have seen it, it's really a weird movie, because it's like a 50-50, you know, kind of thing. It's like some people really liked it and some people say meh.
Right.
But I think it's the best Iron Man movie that is out there.
I know I liked both of them. I think Iron Man 1 is great. Just really tight, solid movie. I liked Iron Man 2, but not as much. I liked it a lot. I thought it was a lot better than some of the people that criticized it, but I didn't think it was as focused as the first one.
I don't know what they'll ever do. Like, you can replace the Hulk, right? You could change the actor of the Hulk. You can change Batman.
Mm-hmm.
They've done it a gazillion times, but damn it, when you take Downey Jr. away from Tony Stark, especially, God, it's gonna be such a different movie.
It's like he
made that character him. I mean,
yeah.
So
yeah, if anyone ever does, they'll have to really take their own approach to it,
right?
You know. And hopefully just do something different enough.
I just wish DC would get off their asses and start doing what Marvel's doing. But hopefully Superman by far has been my most anticipated based on the preview movie to date, like for this year. But damn it, there's a good movie coming out every week now.
It's a huge year for like comic book and geeky movies.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the that Tom Cruise one, Oblivion. That was good.
I didn't see that. I still have a hard time with Tom Cruise, man.
I thought it was great. I don't really care.
I can get past it if it's a good movie, but he does irritate me.
I usually like Tom Cruise movies. I think he's annoying, but
yeah,
I like I'm a fan of Top Gun, Days of Thunder,
Yeah, back then, I mean, that was before he got all crazy. But
I even like the latest one that he was before this one, the Jack Reacher one. I enjoyed the hell out of that.
I think Superman probably is the one I'm most looking forward to. Although, and that's even without, I avoid trailers as much as possible. I see them if I see them in the theater, but otherwise I don't jump on previews and stuff as soon as they hit the internet or anything.
I don't either. And the only reason I say Superman, like my wife's, you should check this out. You check it. I don't even want to see it. But when I go to a theater and see it, it's that much better usually, because I'm not watching it in this little device and this the experience. And
right, at least you're getting the big screen. And
yeah.
But I would have to say the Star Trek looks, I forget what we went to see that we saw a preview ahead of it, but I saw a preview for that in the theater, and that looks really awesome.
Yeah, Into the Darkness looks really good.
Yeah, it looks pretty badass. So, we'll see.
Yeah. All right, well, I will talk to you again, I guess, in 2 weeks.
Yeah, let me know what your schedule looks like.
Vacation this week, so nice. I'll be in Arizona, but I'll talk to you when I get back.
All right, cool. Sounds good. Have a good time.
All right, and do you want to jump back into Kirby on the next one?
Sure.
Maybe finish the Flash, because it's only like 2 more issues.
Yeah, we might as well finish this trade.
Yeah.
And then we can jump back to Volume 3. So, what number episode is this? 12?
Yeah, I think 13? It's 12. 12 or 13. This is Geek Brunch episode. Well, I have the page up here. Hold on a second.
Yeah, I was just going to pull it up. But yeah, this has been Geek Brunch Retrocast episode
12.
12. And I'm Chris Ivey.
And I'm Mike Myers. And you can reach us at geekbrunchpodcast.com and on Twitter at MythMakingETC and at Mike Myers Brunch. And we appreciate all the questions you've given us and discussion points.
Yeah, thanks for the folks that came through last minute and gave us some stuff to talk about for this episode.
Yep. And what else? Oh, we're on Facebook. You could join the Geek Brunch page, which is for Geek Brunch and Geek Brunch Retro, and stay up on the latest episodes and such, mm-hmm. and see all the cover images that Chris posts.
Yeah.
Books we cover. And what else? Oh, we have a forum for geeks. If you scroll down to Geek Brunch, there's also a thread there. And
if you want to be the first person to email me, you would do so via mythmakingetc@gmail.com. And Mike's email is mike@comicbooknoise.com.
Yeah, I don't get too many emails.
Nah.
Usually it's from somebody who wants to advertise on my page.
Yeah. Nobody emails with Twitter and Facebook around.
Yeah.
Like one of my college friends actually sent me an email instead of a Facebook message. And I was like, whoa, what the hell? But, okay.
All right, well, have a good one. We'll talk
you
to you
too.
Soon. I almost
All
forgot
right.
to do the outro.
I know, it sounded like you were ready to say goodbye.
I'm glad you remembered.
That's why it's good to do a podcast with somebody else.
Yeah, I was totally going to space it out. I was so much, we did 2 DC Noise last night, so I'm kind of out of it.
Yeah, I'm sure that takes a toll.
All right, well, I'll talk to you later.
All right, bye.